Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome from Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and today on Mages, Stages, and Seers, I'm proud to bring you Serpentis Satori. Greetings, Satori. How are you?
All right.
So what lands are we going to explore today in the mystical and the mythical?
Well, last year on the live-action DC shows, both live-action DC show, both Titans and Doom Patrol had the characters go into the underworld.
Yes.
And we didn't talk about it at the time, but I think since it did pop up in both shows about 2 weeks apart, depending on how you watch that stuff, it generated a lot of conversation about that, especially how it was portrayed in Titans.
For those who haven't watched,
and then we
can you explain that a little bit for
well,
those
I mean,
who haven't watched other episodes?
Well, it's a classic thing that is that they even get into in Love and Thunder. It's that at a certain point in the heroic path, you have to go into the underworld and deal with your father or your ancestors or the crewmen who have died or something like that.
Correct.
In Titans, they sort of arbitrarily killed off Donna Troy at the end of the previous season, much to the fans' dissatisfaction with getting rid of Donna Troy in such a stupid way. So then they decide to bring her back in the next season, and there's this whole thing Raven does to bring her back. But from Donna's point of view, there's this whole thing about being on a train in the underworld, and she's self-aware that the train is a metaphor for not wanting to move on in the underworld and not being able to go back.
Mm-hmm.
Because she makes a comment to another character about that. It's such an obvious metaphor for our situation.
Most certainly is.
And that's an interesting way of looking at the souls who haven't yet crossed the river and are still in the realm of shadow, especially since in that show, they filmed that whole episode in black and white.
Mm-hmm.
Which gave it a very different feel, but the idea about being in the underworld where it's all black and white and where all the heroes that have died thus far in the show get to make appearances in the underworld.
And their particular situation is also reviewed, and if you're familiar with the characters, then you can understand why they find themselves in these roles in the underworld.
Yeah.
Since it's necessary for the hero to get into the underworld and to transverse its many locales, depending on the mythical system, maybe she wasn't killed for nothing. Maybe it was in order for the show to be able to portray them doing that.
I think they did it because of the Gotham scenario were all for lower power characters, and they got rid of Raven and Donna, who are the most powerful, to make the other characters, to really keep the other characters in danger against Red Hood and Scarecrow. But it still looked like, from a fan perspective, that when they did that to Donna in such a weird way in the last couple minutes of the previous season, and the second season had enough other problems before it did that.
Mm-hmm. Now, a question. They only did 3 seasons of both shows. Is that correct? And all 3 seasons have been filmed?
Now, season 4 for both shows is on its way.
Okay.
They filmed them both. They haven't given them release times yet, but normally Titans had been coming out right after Halloween.
Mm-hmm.
In the beginning of November, and normally Doom Patrol has a shorter season and comes out and starts a couple weeks later, but who knows with what's going on with Warner Brothers right now?
Yeah, I know. With all the changes, frequent changes they're becoming, and every time they change, the scenario shifts in terms of what's going to happen with the shows. And like I'm looking at the Arrowverse, which lasted for a good decade so far, and I've heard four or five different official plans on what's going to happen to the Arrowverse. I know they've discontinued most of the shows, but not all of them. And then there's talk that they're making
the only show that hasn't been discontinued is Stargirl.
And
Stargirl's the only show that's not canceled.
Superman and Lois, I believe, hasn't been canceled either.
Yeah. But both of those shows are in their first couple of years. And I haven't gotten around to Superman and Lois yet. It kept moving on me. It wasn't on CW when I tried to watch it on CW, and then it migrated to HBO, and then I don't know where it is right now.
It's a good interpretation with a different angle on the Superman legend. And as we know, and as we've discussed countless times, these are our modern mythologies. You know, in antiquity, they had Jason, the Argonauts, the Caledonian boar hunt, you know, all the different myths that we grew up with and are familiar with.
And they outright say that in Love and Thunder. They outright say that at the end of Love and Thunder. Zeus himself says it.
So... The fact that mythology is still so strong here in our modern age, you know, speaks a lot into who we are and how we actually process our experiences. But I like both those shows. They were very different than the other DC shows, and they were very well done, you know, with the budgetary constraints that they had. And I was sad to hear that they were canceled, like when they canceled Swamp Thing, which was, again, very unique in its topic and presentation.
Swamp Thing was very, very good. I know a lot of people saw it. Well, everyone I know who saw it used to live in New Orleans. We're all biased on that one. But it was a very good interpretation. It was a very good show. And they probably were trying to set up Zatara and Dark Justice, and then they didn't.
It's like with Caprica with the Battlestar Galactica franchise. It finally found its voice when they canceled it. And Swamp Thing, I felt the same
because
way.
Because they lost their whole crew to because those people all took over Torchwood.
Yes, yes.
All those people took over Torchwood, which killed Caprica.
But
because of how Hollywood works.
They tried to resolve it, and they did, I'd say, for what they attempted to do, they resolved it very well, the story, considering they had to drop it at its very beginning. But still, I really enjoyed that show, and it finally found its most powerful form of expression, and then no more.
Well, that show also begins with a virtual human sacrifice to Hecate.
Yes, it does.
That at the time, no one wanted to tell me. Everybody's just like, just sit down and have a strong drink before you watch the first episode. Like, yeah. But that show worked in an interesting way because it was sort of like Pranos with the future admiral as like a kid. And it worked. It just wasn't the military drama that Galactica was, so it didn't attract the same audience.
No, and the reimagined Galactica, because I usually like the original shows rather than the remakes, but I must say Battlestar Galactica won me over after my initial reluctance to watch it. And then I got hooked into the story. It was very powerful themes from the Bible, from Greek mythology, from all sorts of other mythologies, and they translated them into the science fiction format. And then the science fiction format wasn't science fiction-y. They kept it very grounded in our reality. So the issues that they dealt with that were modern social issues like science fiction does were very, very clear. No guessing about metaphors in Battlestar Galactica. It was like the issues were right there.
Well, that's the thing is, if Battlestar Galactica had three more years for the middle, when it was getting really British political drama,
mm-hmm.
if they'd had three more years of middle, that would have all been good stuff too. Because the half season we get of middle with like the Union episode and the episode about like case system in the military. Those were all good episodes. And Battlestar Galactica really holds up.
Yes, it does.
I mean, even Babylon 5 holds up, but Babylon 5 is different to watch it now.
Yes, it is. With all that's going on politically in our world, it's very frightening how prophetic some of these shows were.
Well, Babylon 5 is theoretically getting a reboot for a year from now.
I've been hearing that, though, since they canceled the show, so I don't know.
It's been going on for 6 years. For 6 years, they've been telling us it's coming back next autumn.
Uh-huh.
But now they're trying to get more middle-aged people to watch CW. Well, they're trying to get all of your friends and my friends to watch CW rather than just watch one show on CW.
Mm-hmm.
And a good way to get more middle-aged people to watch CW would be to bring Babylon 5 back.
That is very true. He's been trying.
And of course, it won't be exactly the same, but there's plenty to talk about politics, and especially if they just restart from 10 years after the Earth-Mimbari War and tell a different story from 10 years after the Earth-Mimbari War, because the Earth-Mimbari War is a shadow over everything in the first two seasons of Babylon 5.
That yeah, that
none of the,
they told the story from a different angle. My concern was that he wanted to tell the same story, just tell it over again, and I didn't think that was a good idea.
He said recently that he wasn't going to tell the same story in the same way, and the current politics are different.
That sounds good, then. He did an excellent job.
Yeah, that sounds like it's going to be good if we get it.
Yeah, he wrote almost every show himself, and that was a feat. He wrote like 5 years of episodes, all of them except for maybe one or two.
Yeah, because Neil Gaiman wrote one. Yeah, something like that. It's like four episodes or so.
Okay, I'll concede to that.
No, it's something around there. It's not even a dozen. It's a handful, it's not a dozen.
It's still impressive. He wrote a lot.
Oh, yeah.
On his own.
Especially when you're doing 22 episode seasons.
Yes.
It's one thing to write up every episode yourself when you're doing a Disney length TV show of 6 hours. It's a completely different thing to do something that's network TV and have 22 episodes and write every single episode.
I like how he handled the Vorlons. That was one of my favorite things about Babylon 5, that they were our mythical gods, and we saw them according to the lens of our own beliefs. So they appeared to everybody differently. And they were very alien and really hard to read. And some were friendly toward the human race, and some were very hostile towards the human race, and confusingly, they had the same name, like Kosh, I believe, was the name of the Vorlon.
Yeah, we are all Kosh, yeah.
After he sacrificed himself for everybody in Babylon 5, the next one to come, who was hostile, was Kosh also. I have one of the plastic Kosh figures. I have things to recall about the gods. And one of the figures is Kosh, for reasons we just talked about. Another figure I have is the Q from Star Trek The Next Generation initially, and then who made his way into the other franchises as well under Star Trek, because they are two, you know.
John Delancey's Q, the Q we see the most, right? Not the Rebel.
Yeah, that Q. And he reminds us that the gods may be tricksters. And then the engineers from Prometheus, which is part of the Aliens and Predator and Blade Runner franchises. You know, he belongs to that particular mythology because there, too, you know, that the gods might have created us for their own purposes and not necessarily our purposes. So I have them all together. And when I'm contemplating higher things, they remind me, they ground me, not to get too lost in some of my speculations.
Yeah. Yeah, and Love and Thunder does that too with how it handles the City of the Gods.
Now, that's something that I haven't seen anybody talking about it anywhere, so I guess we'll start talking about it here and we'll continue it on another show. The City of the Gods, or the Heaven of the Gods, and Heavens for Gods have been popping up a lot in popular culture. They've been popping up in comic books. They've been popping up in movies. They've been popping
and
up
I tie,
in...
And I'm going to tie that back into what I'm doing, because a friend of mine who was a cowboy passed recently. I was the one who, while I sang his soul back home, I took him to the heaven he belongs in.
Okay.
And but because he's a cowboy, he ends up in the heaven where John Wayne is God. That's hinted at in Sandman.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a thing that scrolls by in one of the comics about how, but the Japanese have John Wayne and Marilyn Monroe and blah 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 blah, and it just sort of flies by in Sandman. But when I was doing his underworld journey, when we got to heaven, we go through like the double doors you go through when you enter a saloon. And at first, I think I'm in Westworld. So for a moment, I'm concerned I've accidentally gone to Westworld. And then I take a look around and I realize that these are all like modern Texas cowboys here.
Okay.
All the cowboys in this realm all have Rolexes and stuff. These aren't cowboys who passed after the Civil War. These are all modern cowboys who have died since the 60s. And then I have to do Take Me to Your Leader. Okay, I think I'm in the right place. I have to turn this paperwork into the leader guy. Who's the leader? Take Me to Your Leader. And then it's John Wayne. John Wayne? John Wayne on the white horse.
Oh, very nice.
John Wayne on the white horse is the leader.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And in terms of the Greek mythos, Elysium is the best heaven that people can imagine. And there's not just one Elysium, one size fits all Elysium. There are many Elysiums. There's the Elysium for good people who want to live a good, pleasant life with their families. There's the Elysium of the mystics. There's the glam Elysium for those who left their mark on the world and entertained the gods. You know, there's all these different Elysiums, and your heaven is what your heaven is. And if other people share it, those other people will share it with you after you leave here.
And then he makes me stay and drink.
Okay.
I'm really trying to do it as a drop off and be like, okay, man, interesting. I know what heaven number this is. I don't come here very often. And John Wayne's like, sit down, drink. I know who you are. Like, oh, hi. And so then I'm late for something else I'm supposed to do in the astral. So the people I'm supposed to be meeting with have to figure out where I am and grab me where I am. So I end up having my friend, who is pretty much the real Raven from the DC universe, blow in, and another friend, but because they come to the saloon doors and your clothes get translated, they both look like they're in Westworld.
Yep.
At which point Raven, in her perfectly dry Raven, says, you know you're late. And my other friend is like, is that who I think it is? Like, yes, let me introduce both of you to His Lordship John Wayne, King of this realm, Lord and Master of his realm.
So they went all out then.
Is this? No, because we end up there longer than we meant to be, and it screwed up what else I was supposed to do. But that also leads to a conversation between the three of us when we wake up about, like, the weirdest heaven you've ever taken someone to.
Now, these
although
heavens...
I think when Harry Anderson passed and I went to the mystic castle we saw in She-Hulk, is also in Clive Barker's Lord of Illusion and is a real place in Los Angeles. There is a level of, if you're a stage magician and you die, part of your soul must stay in Mystic Castle, because most stage magicians I've ever found in the other world seem to think they're in that building. And when I took Harry Anderson there, he was like, oh, no, I know where I am. Here, wait, the bar's here. Wait, wait, there's a paperwork thing you have to do. I'm like, yeah, I need a stamp. This needs stamps so I can turn it into a cafe. There's a guy with a stamp around here somewhere.
Well, we've had this.
And they didn't believe that.
Before, but what? The time, linear time is an illusion. We've talked about that, excuse me, before. And I know in my own meditations, there are, in my own astral journeys and my own voyages, there are places where I always am that are totally separate and apart from here. And time does not pass there like it passes here. So I'm always there. So I imagine this is the same type of concept. You know, they're always there in that place, so they know where they are. And their being somewhere else might be incidental because they're also where they always are.
Yeah. But it's just interesting as we get into the many Elysiums or many paradise realms, how many there really are. And if you do the soul walking thing enough, you do have some stories that are like, yeah, but that's that weird. That's D&D heaven. What? There's no such place. Oh, yeah, there is. The realm where Gary Gygax is God. Yep, there's a real place. It's busy there. It's like Gen Con forever. Busy.
Well, when
Gen Con with liquor carts.
When D&D first came out with the Manual of the Planes, I remember I looked through that, and then I had to own it because they rated really esoteric tomes.
Yeah, they did.
Information, yeah. And make it into a fantasy that anybody can play, you know, with their friends. Again, I don't agree with all of their interpretations, but the very fact that they gather things together and arrange them into a circle with spokes and a hub, and they added the elemental planes and the astral and the etheric, and then the shadow realm and the fae, all of these realms that before they put it into a game, very few people knew about. Now all of a sudden we're, bang, part of the popular imagination. And I've been watching over the years which of these places pop up all over, and then wondering what that could mean. That now, what can it mean that Devakan or Devaloka, the best place that the gods can imagine, is popping up all over the place in their entertainment? So I don't have an answer yet.
Gods playing tennis. No, my friends who picked me up in John Wayne's heaven, we had to go that direction. So Raven jokes about it, and this is the realm where the gods play tennis and don't answer the phone. Let's find Hermes.
A lot of people didn't like Love and Thunder. I enjoyed the movie very much. It was a lot of fun, and again, it contained a lot of esoteric information presented in a very quirky way, but the information was there. You knew what you were listening to and looking at.
Yeah, but it's also because you and I are more used to, well, because the middle of the movie is an underworld journey. And like I told my current magic student when she wanted to know what I thought of it, I told her that it was a horror movie for children about dying of cancer.
That's a unique way of looking at it. But yeah, that accurately describes the movie.
Well, because that contains all of the negative. All of the negativity means you didn't get something I said in that sentence. You either didn't understand that it wasn't a horror movie for 20-year-olds, it's a horror movie for 10-year-olds. And it works as a horror movie for 10-year-olds. It's very good at being that. But a lot of people didn't get it because they didn't like all of the humor. Or they didn't love.
There was
I liked Natalie Portman as Thor. I have always liked Jane Astor.
There was a four-hour version as well, and they said it was a lot more Monty Python-esque, the four-hour version. Of course, they had to cut it for a theatrical release, but there were scenes that have come out, like where Zeus was not hostile and taught him how to use the lightning bolt and told him that, you know, basically the weapon doesn't matter. And that entire portion of the movie was taken out altogether. And Thor went back to being the god of hammers again, ignoring Odin's comment in the movie previously that he...
Ignoring everything he learned in the last movie.
Right.
Everything he learned in his last movie.
But he
I just rewatched all those.
Uh-huh. Yes, so did I. He became the god of hammers again. He became more than hammers, but the fact that all this power was in him and the hammer was just a device, a ritual device, if you will, to focus his energy and to reinforce his belief, like any magical prop. That seems to have been lost on him again, and he went back to, again, the needing the hammer and having that attachment to the symbol rather than the actual thing the symbol represents.
Yeah, but I mean, that's also part of Thor Skywalker did a really long thing about Thor's heroic journey and how screwed up it is in the Marvel movies. Go look up the Thor Skywalker piece on YouTube. He goes into that in a lot of detail and a lot of depth, and does look at it from the Campbell and heroic journey perspective. But it's also interesting, if you look at the Campbell heroic journey of all of the Avengers, the only one who actually makes the heroic journey correctly is Natasha. Natasha's the only one who's on the classical hero journey. Everybody else's journeys are screwed up.
Well, could that be because they might not be bringing Natasha back, whereas all the rest are tied up into additional movies? So them sacrificing themselves for the world and it's sticking, because in Marvel, you know, death doesn't last very long for some characters. But if she's finished with her story and they moved on past her, then, yeah, that would be a good reason to ever complete her hero journey and in a really grand way.
Well, right, but I mean, of the Avengers, as separate from the X-Men, because, well, again, back to the Western, Logan is one of the best superhero movies of all time, and Logan was a great way to wrap up the Fox X-Men franchise.
Yes, it was.
And it works fine as a standalone movie, but it's a much better movie if you've seen all of the other movies.
Which we recently did. We watched all of them. The order is kind of difficult to determine sometimes, but we watched all of them in the best order we could create for them after consulting several online suggestions. And then we capped it off with Logan.
Because that's a great movie.
Yeah,
and a great...
And they never tell you exactly what happened either. You know, you could kind of guess, but what actually
happened? Yeah, they do.
Happened...
The adamantium skeleton is poison. Adamantium and vibranium are poison.
Correct.
He's dying of cancer too. He's dying of cancer, but it's in his bones. He has bone cancer because adamantium is toxic.
No, that is easy to figure out. It's what exactly happened. Who killed the X-Men up in upstate New York? Was it Professor Xavier's, or did he force Wolverine to do it? That you could argue both ways, you know, in terms of how it's written. They never clearly told you exactly what happened. They hinted around it for the
entire movie. They wanted to leave it ambiguous that it was possible that it was done by the other group or by Phoenix.
Yeah,
the first time I saw it, I thought that was ambiguously hinting that Phoenix had gotten out of control and killed everybody else.
That's a possibility, too. And at one point, Xavier says that he remembers what happened exactly. but again, he never verbalizes what happened exactly. So there were a lot of question marks with that movie. I thought they were going to continue with his daughter. It seemed and I remember reading someplace that they were going to make a bunch of movies with her as the central person, and the other kids that escaped is like the new X-Men team. Because Fox was sold to Disney, that never happened.
Yeah, now they're going to try to re-merge them. And originally they were going to do X-Men versus Avengers, and no one wants to see that.
Well, doing that now,
no one even liked that story the first time.
Now they're doing X-Men versus Avengers versus Eternals in the comic. And I'm wondering how much of that has to do with what they plan on doing with the Eternals in the movies, because they kind of left that dangling with a giant god being born of the egg of Earth in the middle of the Indian Ocean. And they never addressed it since then, but they announced the second Eternals. So it might be tied into the storyline from the comic, I'm guessing. In the comic, the Eternals who... are created to keep deviation at a minimum in the evolution of humanity, decide that the mutants are deviants because they've mutated, and therefore they're excess deviation. So the Eternals want to eliminate all the mutants. And then the Avengers are caught in the middle of this thing that's going on between the X-Men and the Eternals.
That sounds like an interesting reflection of our current times.
Very much so. So again, the mythology is not dead. It lives in different forms. And even if you look at these forms carefully, as we've discussed endlessly, it's the same archetypes in different guises. So Superman, for instance, is the solar hero. He's Heru or Ra or the Egyptians. He's Heracles or Helios or Apollo of the Greeks. They're in their forms. You have a speedster like Hermes in The Flash and in Quicksilver in the Marvel Universe. So it's not difficult to see the old mythical figures in the new mythologies. The new mythologies now have become the major form of entertainment for our planet. So there's a global mythology now that ties us all together. There's a couple of them, but Marvel is by far the most powerful at this point in time. If anything happens to our civilizations, scholars of the future are going to wonder how our mythologies globally have very similar figures, like they wonder now about figures in our past, which hints at a global civilization in antiquity. And that people like you, like me, like very many others who understand how shamanism works, find themselves in the realms that don't just reflect the ancient mythic images, but are very much updated according to what's going on in the psyches of people in the time that we live in, as well as the psyches of people who lived in times past.
And the overlap is completely obvious in Moon Knight. Anyone I know who knows anything about Egyptian religion who saw Moon Knight at a couple of points had to like rewatch entire episodes because they're like, they actually did do that. They actually did say that.
Mm-hmm.
They got away with that on Disney. Like the temple that's shaped like an Eye of Horus.
Mm-hmm.
And the explanation we're giving to 10-year-olds about the Eye of Horus in the Disney show.
Yep, I have several folks also in our Mages, Sages, and Seers programs who have remarked the same thing, that they had to watch Moon Knight again and again. Again, because they couldn't believe what they were seeing. Things that, again, unless you had the personal experiences yourself, you wouldn't really know because they hadn't been shared before. Now they're shared on television with millions of people watching them.
Yeah, but lots of my ISIS cultist friends ended up having to reality check that, and then they call me and they're like, "But they just did that on Disney." Like, they did a lot of stuff in Moon Knight that I'm surprised they got away with.
Such as
including the underworld journey. The underworld journey in Moon Knight is perfect. It's exactly what's supposed to happen in Egypt. It's very much by the Book of the Dead.
Yes, and now,
and that was pretty shocking to a lot of people.
And now in the popular imagination, also there are heavens for gods, and that there are places that the gods aspire to dwell in rather than on their own home plane, you know, where the pantheon is situated, or and that they could travel around as tourists or as adventurers in other realms using simple shamanic techniques that humans possess if they choose to.
Or a sling ring. Pick yourself up a sling ring.
Yeah, the implications are very interesting to ponder. And again, the very fact that mythology only grows very strong during times of crisis in the past. That's when mythology starts to dominate a culture. And it's even observable if you follow what's happened with comic books alone and then superhero TV shows and movies. Whenever we're going through a very stressful time, those mediums tend to tell tales of the modern gods, the superheroes. And we're seeing that right now, and we must be in awful crisis collectively, because it's become our dominant form of entertainment. So we need the gods at this particular time, and that's how they responded through these movies and other entertainments. And the Egyptians were represented
because of how they hold everything together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there were Egyptians,
and because we have reflections of the main archetypes in all of the groups, whichever family you're mythically part of, in whether it's the Marvel Universe or the DC Universe.
Oh, they're talking about having DC meets Marvel. The Rock's been promoting that now for a while, and others have mentioned it before. But on some drawing board somewhere, there are plans
Comcast and Hulu. The way that would connect would be through Comcast and Hulu.
Can you explain that?
There is discussion of that, because Hulu is partially owned by Comcast and partially owned by Disney.
Yes.
If you've been following entertainment news this week, both parents want custody. They don't want joint custody anymore. Both parents want sole custody of Hulu at this point. The problem is there's no good they have to both agree. In this divorce, they have to both agree on who gets full custody, and they have to both agree. If Paramount and Comcast were to buy Warner, then Hulu could end up a place where Hulu would have the thing that was hinted at in Doomsday Clock about Superman meets Thor.
Okay.
If Paramount bought Warner Brothers outright and is still stuck with the custody situation with Hulu, which it might be stuck with for a very long time, Hulu would probably end up the membrane of crossing over Titans with She-Hulk or Titans with Moon Knight.
That would be interesting.
Because at that's something. Well, once the new Marvel game came out, my ex-girlfriend, who might as well be Donna Troy, she started a game where, based on the rules that game has, you have a superpower called Blades, which means claws like Wolverine, but also can mean a sword. And they have a different superpower called Shield Master. So she and I, when we were playing out, like when we were teaching ourselves combat over the phone, we rolled up characters who were essentially like knight characters, characters with swords and shields. And we did like a basic D&D combat in the Marvel system just to check it out. And that was a lot of fun. I can completely see why she's got people crawling out of the walls to play her game. Like, yeah, because the sword and shield thing in the new Marvel system is actually quite a bit of fun. It would be interesting to do gladiator combat.
characters in the new Marvel system just for fun.
I have to revisit it. I read through it, and again, there's some parts of it that I could adopt into the role-playing things that I run for people. But I didn't really see anything of great value yet. I figured I'd give it a chance with the release of the complete rule book rather than the sampler. But now that you said that, I will approach it from that angle and see what I see.
I'll talk to you in a minute about my thoughts on that, because on some level, my New Orleans group were like the Young Gods.
Okay.
Getting drunk on Bourbon Street. The Young Gods on Bourbon Street. And I have some thoughts about where I disagree with that rule book about gods. But if you were to create demigods and were to do something more Rorden-like with that, I have some thoughts on that I'll share with you in private. But
okay.
I've been thinking about that, and I was especially thinking about that after she and I just basically did, like, it was basically just a combat test to check out, you know, how damage works, how hit points work, how initiative works. What we were trying to do really was just a basic run through of combat with each other. And when she read those rules, she's like, no, let's just have two paladins slug it out. That's a good basic combat. You and I both understand.
Mm-hmm.
You and I both understand, like, no. Ah, crap, you broke my shield. That is a cool blade attack. That's cool. I have to remember that. And the strategic master stuff is actually pretty good for creating characters like Captain America. The way that all works is actually pretty good when you start getting into fighting large groups of Hydra agents and stuff. I was impressed with that too. And I haven't actually gotten a chance to play it. I've just had my roommate roll up a character. And I haven't started a game yet, but most of what I did at this point was just combat testing and combating the characters who are in the back of the book with each other to see who wins between Captain America and Spider-Man.
Well, who wins?
Spider-Man wins because Spider-Man can web him up.
Okay. Good point.
If Spidey can keep getting initiative, he wins.
Yeah, I have a group this Saturday in Branchville, and we've done like guided visualization and astral projection and journeying and dreams, and you know we're still playing with those. I was thinking of introducing some role playing concepts because they fit in really well with the other work that we've done, and I'm going to do it diceless initially. And see if they like it. If they like it, I'll introduce a randomness factor through the dice. If not, I could just modify it a little bit and use one of the many diceless systems that are out there. Modify that and use that instead.
Dice are an important element because it does represent the uncontrollable.
Right.
Like in our little sword fight, the shield character, if he continued to get initiative, he would actually defeat the sword character eventually. The sword character, if he always got initiative, and because of he has to get initiative and he has to roll good damage to defeat the shield character. If he doesn't do that, that fight really can go for 4 or 5 hours. And we were only using rank 5 characters because we wanted it to be over quickly. And rank 5 characters don't have a lot of hit points.
Yeah, my purpose in introducing it is to unfetter their imaginations. So at this point, if I introduce like a constraint like fate into the equation or uncertainty, it might start constraining imaginations. I find that generally, whether I worked in human services or in metaphysics or in mental health over the years, that a lot of people are very hard on themselves, more so than anybody else is hard on them. and they tend to think ill of themselves rather than good of themselves. So something is needed to break that way of looking at things slowly. Or as quickly as the person can assimilate that, because it's a difficult thing to assimilate, and it's very scary to people who think in very negative, limiting ways. So the role-playing allows you to create characters and to imbue them with whatever qualities you'd like, and then to act as if the attributes of the character are your character, since you're acting through the vehicle of the character. So again, if I use a diceless system with no constraints, I can unfetter their imaginations, and then they can be free to imagine without worrying about a number initially. Again, later on, every interactive field needs some rules, even visualization and, because I remember when I did visualization, so I learned how to do that. I would start at the standard beach scene, not taking into account that some people are afraid of the beach. They're afraid of getting burnt by the sun. They're afraid of being eaten by sharks. They're afraid of being having sand kicked in their face or something. But there's a fear there. So in the selection of the beach, there are always going to be some people that instead of relaxing there would find it very stressful. So I had to basically pre-plan my locations and talk it through with people before I took them there on an imaginal journey where they could relax or, attain another state that they wanted to attain by breathing in and out and visualizing, basically, or making affirmations. So the same thing in the game. So I'm going to start them off in a good place with unlimited powers as their divine selves. Then later on, if that's something comfortable to them and that's something that is empowering to them, then I'll start adding some rules to structure the experience and to make it more interactive and less imaginal. But until I get there, I'm thinking just imagination alone with a game-like format should do it.
That's just pure role playing.
Yeah, it would be pure role-playing in one sense, but it would make use of the other techniques, the guided visualizations and the journeying and the astral projection type of techniques and the dream work techniques. It would just use them while a person's awake and not necessarily...
Well, on a related note, my friend who is Raven joked with me recently, the way they make miniatures for role-playing games now is almost all of them are 3D printed. Mostly they are plastic and 3D printed. And when she and I were talking about that, when I was explaining the sword fight scenario to her and walked her through, I didn't photograph those character sheets for any of you. I walked her through how we did it. She jokes with me about, those of us who are demigods really should have some empathy for those 3D printed figures because we are them. And all we do is get weird paint jobs and get dropped in different universes.
That's a great way of looking at it. I need to meditate on that.
Well, that's Raven for you. That's Raven being herself about that, but because we were talking about like, The miniatures she had that had sword and shields weren't from the same fantasy realities. For her to play that out with Flork, she had to use some Warhammer miniatures, some of those old British plasticky ones that you used to buy at the toy store. Some of her knights are from there. So she was joking about, like, if she decided to do more than four characters, she was going to have to start mixing and matching with that. And then she's like, but wait, we're using Marvel to do D&D. We were testing out the sword rules. I wanted to see how the sword rules worked, and so did Donna Troy. We were just testing out the sword rules, and we're like, if we're going to have swords, let's have shields. We're going to have shields and swords. We can't have horses yet. We can't do jousting.
Well, horses you can pick up at the 99-cent store sometimes. They have packages of...
Wait, within the Marvel rules. Within the Marvel rules, we don't yet have... No, shoot. We were talking about how the fact that the rules in the Marvel game don't allow us to joust yet.
Okay.
Because we don't really have horses or motorcycles. And so because we don't really have vehicle movement rules in Marvel yet, it meant there was going to be no jousting.
Yeah, this is a new thing now. Game companies are selling their playtest material. Before, they used to give it away. Wizards of the Coast, Hasbro, is coming out with a new edition of D&D. I think they're calling it D&D 1, and it's coming out in 2 years. They're releasing all their playtest material for free online. Just sign up to receive it, and boom, there you go. If you want to print it out, you can print it out, but if not, you can read it on your computer.
Yeah, but I mean, that was her comment about that, and when I started thinking about that, especially when you think about, like, the different versions of Doctor Strange in multiverse.
Mm-hmm.
About, it's all how you paint the miniature. Those miniatures were just painted by different people. Oh.
That's very true. And because, again, time is not linear, and we have memories of other times and other places that are also in their nows. That would be a really interesting way of looking at it. Hadn't thought of it that way, but okay. Tonight I'll meditate on that.
That's how the children of Hecate were reaffirming with each other about that, and having and being able to laugh about it at the same time.
A lot of interesting things happening in our world right now that are again being reflected in these entertainments that also reflect the appropriate mythical archetypal interactions at the same time. We're living in a very interesting time.
That's a curse. In Chinese, that's a curse.
So it is said. I can see it as a blessing, though, too.
Well, it does mean that all the colorful people show up when worlds are in crises like this. All the colorful characters are all in the same worlds.
And the gods.
Because they're like, let's team up Raven and Scarlet Witch. Let's have Raven and Scarlet Witch be in the same adventure. Let's see what happens.
But these aren't...
In this world, those two did not get along.
We unfortunately have only like 5 more minutes in today's conversation, so we'll have to pick up that thread on another day or continue it between shows. But this time, I don't know if it's because we have information technology, so information spreads lightning fast and immediately, whereas before you had to listen to the radio and not trust the things you're hearing for the first couple of days, and then wait to see the papers, and then picking your most trustworthy or sensational paper, whatever you preferred, and starting with that understanding. Now, within minutes, we're informed of things. The interpretations have grown much more extreme and often irreconcilable in terms of what's actually going on. And it's difficult to navigate through this. And I think part of the whole multiverse, you know, where everything's jumbled together and it's hard to make sense of what's going on, is a reflection of that primal chaos that's affecting us through the information media.
I think it's just a general awareness of humanity growing up, that back 30 years ago, the only way you knew about the multiverse was from that thing in D&D. And back then, Doctor Who was able to travel through the multiverse before they took that away in the new show, where he only gets to do that once.
Yeah, I've been following Doctor Who in quite a while.
I sort of... It's after Capaldi regenerated into Whittaker, because I just wasn't able to. It stopped being a fun kids show. It's supposed to be a fun kids show about real stuff, but it just stopped being a fun kids show, and with stopped being a fun kids show, most of my friends and I quit watching, because it wasn't fun anymore.
Yeah, I watched a few episodes early on, and then the Tom Baker years were the ones that I followed, not religiously, but regularly. And then I stopped following it altogether until a conversation we had sparked my interest, and then I got hooked into it for a while, and all the spin-off shows and all the mythical and magical and mind-blowing concepts that were introduced during the journey. But it got a certain point where it's like there's too much to follow. They have audio, they have as well as the video, they have stories, they have comics, they have, it was too big a universe to enter. So I decided not to invest any more in entering it, either time or resources.
Well, you only have to go in as far as you like.
Mm-hmm.
With something like that, it just like, it's interesting that Disney was able, is able to control the conversation by almost making everything on Disney Plus require viewing to be an educated person. Because HBO was there for a long time. For a long time, the good stuff on HBO was what the smart kids were all watching. And then when they screwed up a couple seasons ago with Westworld and everybody quit watching Westworld in its third season, they dropped the ball and they haven't been able to get it back. And now they're dropping all the balls. So who knows what's going to happen with that now.
And I just noticed the time. We have 2 minutes. Can you kindly share how people can get in contact with you and how they can enter your world? I know you started holding classes recently. How can people who are in your area and interested get involved with that?
Right now I'm just talking to people I know because we need to get this all platformed before we go big.
Okay.
And with these, and with our 3 years being year-long things each, they need to be nailed down in a certain way, and I have volunteers to go through these the first time with the new books. Because there's nothing about what we are doing in Hercules Invictus for the three levels that is at all new. Most of this has been around at least since Greek magic was in the gymnasiums. At least. If Isis didn't invent it. Because that's possible too. But we are replatforming it to be about the heroic path and also to reach out to people that understand that the Marvel Universe is our cultural mythology right now.
Mm-hmm.
So for now, I want to just start with the people in my immediate circle who know about my other life as Satori and know about who I was in New Orleans and work through how the new versions of the curriculum alter the message. Because every time you swap out a couple books, you're not doing the same thing you were doing 10 years ago. And that's crystal clear. Well, I mean, okay. We're probably done.
We have a few seconds left. Yeah, to be continued. Can people contact you, or should they contact you through me?
They should contact me through you.
Okay, that works. Thank you, Satori. To be continued, I suspect in a few minutes. And I always enjoy speaking with you, whether it's on the air or off the air. And I look forward to our next conversation.
All right, I will talk to you in a little bit. I have to take care of a couple things.
Okay, be well, my friend, and thank you, and thanks to all who tuned in. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you called and patiently waited in our queue, or whether you're going to watch us later on, or listen to us actually later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys and amazing adventures. Take care, everyone, and thanks again, Satori.